From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of The Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. How's everybody doing out there? Hope you're doing great. Today I have a surprise guest for you, a little off topic, but I'm thinking we're going to have a lot of fun. So let me tell you a little bit about him. For those of you that may not have seen him perform at Wembley Stadium with his dad, David Icke. None other than Gareth Icke, who is a singer, a songwriter, an author. He has a couple of albums out. He's also given us permission to air one of his pieces today. Remember, Love Without Meaning, which of course we'll get into. But today we're really going to be talking about his book. And I have to tell you that his book made me feel like I was 20 years old again as I laughed through most of what went on. The book is called How Not to Be a Rock Star. And of course, it's written by Gareth Icke. So without further ado, let me say good morning to Gareth. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. How's it going for you in sunny England?
Yeah, it's good. It is actually sunny today, believe it or not. We don't get sun much, but it's quite sunny today. It's all right. I'm burnt.
Well, that's good. Gareth, I have to tell you that reading your book was pure pleasure for me. And I found myself, and I'm sure you probably may or may not appreciate it, laughing through most of what you guys went through. And even though some of it was very serious, some of your stories just had me cracking up out loud because, you know, having grown up in New York, in New York City, when I saw your impression and your experiences in New York, I was just laughing to beat the band.
That's great. That's great. That was the main point, to be honest, was just to try and make people laugh. Out of misfortune, really. But, you know, if you can't laugh, you'll cry.
Well, if you don't laugh, you'll cry for sure. Well, you know what's interesting is most of the time, rock groups that write books write because they were successful. You're probably the only person I've ever seen write a book on what not to do if you want to be a rock star. So what possessed you to write it? Is it just something you felt like doing?
Well, to be honest, I was in I was playing a gig up in Glasgow in Scotland a couple of years ago, around Christmas time, and we stood there and after the show and were drinking a few beers and people are sort of exchanging their stories of life on the road and whatever, and I started telling a few stories about the old days in an old band we were in, and to be honest, people didn't believe them, and a guy came up and he basically told me in a, I won't swear, but he did, that I was making it up sort of thing, to which I called over a couple of friends for them to, you know, validate my story because they knew what had gone on. And the guy couldn't believe it. And he was like, you know what, you know, you should write a book. And it just stuck. And I thought, you know what, that's a really good idea because, to be honest, with the amount of drinking we did in those days, my mind's probably going to stop working at some point, so I figured if I don't write it down now, I'll probably forget it by the time I'm old. But yeah, I got together with a few of my bandmates and we started exchanging some of the old stories in the day, and I just thought it was a really nice idea to, because like you said, it's kind of history tends to be written by the winner, and it's the same kind of with autobiographies and stuff. It's kind of always a success story. You know, this is, you know, I was playing a show, someone spotted me, and then 10 years later, I'm a multimillionaire and I've got a model wife, and it's like that's not really how it works, you know.
Right.
For most bands don't ever get anywhere near that. So,
right,
it would be nice to tell the story from the other side. And you know, we had a hell of a lot of fun on the way. Nearly died a bunch of times, but you know,
right.
Surprised to tell the tale.
Well, I have to tell you, it reminded me of when my wild days of my own youth. And, you know, back in the day in New York, of course, we had lots of local bands. And, you know, we would support the local bands wherever they traveled around the city. But I remember them traveling pretty much the same way you did, you know, in a beat up old van, you know, going from gig to gig, you know, happy if they get paid, but, you know, free drinks were okay too. So you show a really different side of what it's like, you know, to pursue your music and be young at the same time.
That's it. That's it. I mean, the great thing about it was because we really believed in what we were doing. You know, most people, they have in their early 20s, they're either having fun and drinking and being an idiot and sort of neglecting any future for themselves, or they're so focused on their future that they don't tend to enjoy themselves. It's all about, you know, getting a promotion and getting a job here and this and that. But because, you know, we believed in what we were doing, we were being the drunken idiots, but at the same time we were focusing on a career and we were doing something. So we're quite lucky, really, to be able to do that and get the best of both,
right,
both worlds, really. Because, I mean, I listen to the old songs now, and it's really strange. And I must admit, when I wrote the book, and then I got off to had it proofread, and I got it sent back to me, and I read it again, and it was quite strange for me, really, because I knew it was me, but it felt like a different person, if that makes any sense.
You know,
I knew those things had happened to me, obviously, because I remember them, but
it was
like reading someone else's book, which was quite an extraordinary feeling, really.
Right. Well, you know,
kind of coming at the same time, I guess.
Right. Well, I can tell you this, having lived a few more decades than you, because your dad and I are about the same age, every 10 years of your life, when you look back, it feels like you're looking at somebody else's life.
Really? Well, I feel like that about my 20s, I must admit. I mean, I'm 31 now, and I do look back, and I think, God, who was that lad? You know.
Right. So it's, you know, to me, it makes perfect sense when you say you read the book, but it seemed like it was somebody else's life. Because sometimes when I think back on my life, I'm like, it just feels like somebody else's life.
Yeah, it is a strange feeling, but it's quite nice as well, because I think, you know, all that stuff that went on happened for a reason, to get you sort of where you are now or whatever. And you know, and then you can focus on something new in your future, whatever. But it was strange, I must admit. It was quite strange to read it back and think, geez, I was an absolute nutter.
I don't know that you were nuts. I think that you were just young, you know, and that's what young people do. Okay, you guys might have taken it to a little excess with your drinking, but, you know, for rock groups, I mean, that's normal. Okay, as far as I know, that's always been normal. You know, you did have a good time. You did what you wanted to do. Of course, while I was reading the book and all your wild adventures, I was wondering, wow, I wonder what his dad was thinking about his son going through all that craziness.
Well, I sent him, when I first started writing the book, because obviously I've never written a book before, so I didn't really know what I was doing. But I wanted to have a different style. I didn't want to just kind of write in the same style as everyone else. So I was sending chapters to my dad at the start, you know, because obviously, you know, he's written a million books, so
right.
I wanted his opinion, and he would just come up with little ideas, and I must admit, it was him that said that my character wasn't coming across enough. Like, the stories were there, and obviously what happened, but I wasn't sort of getting my character across, so I did go back to the drawing board and rewrite it in a different style. So obviously, as you know, because you've read it, it is written as if I'm sat next to you in a pub, and I'm just telling you the story.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of style came from his advice, really, which was, you know, invaluable, to be honest.
Right, right. Well, I want my listeners to know there's absolutely no comparison to Garrett's book and his style of writing to what your dad writes about. But it's all very good. But I did. I really did feel that. You conveyed that well, because I just felt like you were just, like you said, just sitting down next to me, talking to me, telling me your stories. And they were pretty damn funny stories, too. Of course, it wasn't happening to me. If it was happening to me, I don't think it would have been as funny. But since it was happening to you, I could distance myself from it. When did you decide? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go on. Sorry.
Well, I was going to ask, when did you decide to go solo, to come back and have a solo career?
To be honest, the band kind of, it was a strange thing. We got hit so many times, and knocked back so many times, that it kind of winded all of us to a point where we didn't see a future for it, which is sad, really, because I listen to the songs back now, and I think, you know what, we had something, we did have something there, and maybe if we'd have carried on, you know, then it, we could have done something, but I knew that music was what I wanted to do. It just, for the lot of us, we just felt winded, and we didn't feel like we had the energy to pursue it. So I figured I didn't really want to get into another band, because I'd already done that, and I didn't think that whatever band I got in would compete with my old band. I'd always be there sort of comparing the two, which is never good.
Right.
So I figured I'd just, make a go of it on my own. And that, the other thing as well is, you know, touring costs an absolute fortune. So I found when I went solo, I could literally just put an acoustic guitar in the boot of the car and just drive, and I could, you know, I could survive doing that because it was so much cheaper, because I wasn't having to pay for a van and for, you know, other members of the band and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the main reason, and then I love it. I just love playing on my own now, and I feel a lot more freedom as well, because, you know, the band, although I was writing the songs, it was a democracy, so there were certain things that I would want to do and that the other guys wouldn't want to do, whereas now I'm, you know...
Right,
it's only down to me, so I can pretty much do what I want, which is a real nice bit of freedom I have.
Right.
Well,
you know, myself and a lot of my listeners have we're watching your dad at Wembley Stadium and got to see your performance when you came out, which I thought was excellent. What was that like for you? Because I know it was quite the crowd.
It was incredible. The thing is, I must admit, I don't really get nervous before shows. I tend to get, you know, a bit of butterflies in the stomach, which is always good. So, you know, a bit more excitement sort of thing. But for Wembley, for the first performance, I was really, really frightened, actually. It was the first time I ever had been. And the only reason was because it wasn't my audience. You know, it was, you know, I've played to big crowds before at festivals, but the people are there to watch music and stuff. Whereas with this, obviously, they were there to watch my dad and hear what he had to say. So part of me was thinking, you know, what if the audience are like, you know, get off, what are you doing here? I don't care about you. I want to hear what your dad has to say. But they weren't. And as soon as we performed and the audience were amazing, they were, you know, then we were all relaxed and then we could really enjoy it. And I must admit, by the end, I didn't want it to stop. I was thinking, you know, can we get the drink? And Dad had noticed if I snuck in a few more songs.
Right. You know, It kind of reminded me of the Lovin's they used to have in the 60s, you know, back in the day, because I think that's the most relaxed I ever saw your father. And you know, his performance was superb, but you added to it. And of course, everybody in that audience loves your dad, so of course they were going to automatically love you.
Well, that's good. That's good. It was a massive thing for the family, I must admit, Wembley, because not so much in America, but in the UK, you know, it's been a bit of a tough road, really, in terms of, you know, getting stick in the papers and on TV and stuff. You know, the family's been through quite a lot. So for all of us to be there together, you know, in front of that many people, was incredible. And yeah. I think Dad actually had a tear in his eye at one point, which... I don't think he mentions that, but yeah, he did.
Well, I'm sure, you know, as your father, he's very proud of you, and vice versa. And, you know, when your dad came to Phoenix a few years ago, I shared the stage with your father, and it was a whole lot of fun, but I didn't sing, because I'm sure you can tell by my voice you wouldn't want to hear me sing. But I did do some stand-up political comedy for him, and the audience just loved it. And, you know, it was an honor to be on the same stage with your dad.
Well, I kind of felt like that as well, I must admit, which is a bit weird for a son to say. But, yeah, I did, because it's, you know, he is amazing at what he does. It is, you know, I've obviously seen him speak numerous times, you know, since I was a kid. But even at Wembley, you know, I was, even though I knew a lot of the information because obviously we, you know, his family, so we talk about it.
Right.
You know, I was sat there, you know, just as enthralled as the audience. You know, which is amazing, because I must admit, you know, obviously we're in totally different worlds, but obviously playing the music, the job is to maintain the concentration of the audience, and I only have to do that for an hour, you know, sometimes at most shows, and even then it's hard work, you know, to keep people interested.
Right.
Keep them up and down and stuff, and you know, keep locked in.
Yeah, well, I know that's so, you know, that's got to be an exhausting day for your father. But, you know, I talked to him after Wembley, and he told me that he wasn't tired at all. He was actually exhilarated from it.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, which is amazing, because just to keep an audience like that for 10 hours, and, I mean, I couldn't do it. I think my legs would give way.
Right. I even think my voice would give out by the end of the day.
Yeah.
Now, the song you aired there, was that the song What's Love Without Meaning? Was that the one you performed?
It was one of them, yeah. It was one of the songs that we performed. Basically, Dad got in touch with me, because we don't live in the same place. We live about 200 miles apart. And he got in touch and said, you know, he was going to play Wembley Arena, and would I, you know, put together some songs for it. And so, obviously, I had to, you know, write some music that was kind of fitting with his stuff, which was fine by me, because to be honest, I was kind of going that way a little bit anyway. And so, yeah, I put together some songs, and, yeah, What's Love Without Meaning was one of them. And, yeah, it came across really well at Wembley, and the crowd were great, and it was, yeah, I'm buzzing off it now, which is what it was about 6 months ago.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, if, I'd like to actually play that song now for the listening audience, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, it's great. I hope they enjoy it.
Okay, well, here we go. So stay with us. Gareth and I will be back. But here's What's Love Without Meaning by Gareth Ike. So stay with us.
How you are. All those words, three substances that
have it, Love Without Meaning by Gareth Ike. So if you're standing there and you're still dancing, the music stopped. Gareth, that's really a great song. It has a great sound. It's like real music that you can actually dance to, which seems to be sorely missing. Seems to be sorely missing from my granddaughter's generation.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm not. I feel like an old man as well. I don't listen to any new music really. It's not really my, thing. I'm still stuck in the early '90s sort of grunge era myself.
Right. Well, you know, part of your band, which was called Cody, right? K-O-D-Y.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, part of your experience was you did actually get as far as the Cavern where the Beatles started playing in the UK. What was that like for you? Did you think you had finally arrived?
A little bit, yeah. It was an amazing experience to play there, and the sound there is great. The only negative of it was we played a blind-in show. It was filmed by Channel 5, which is... it's, you know, a big-ish TV station in England. And so, it was really good. And then when we came outside, our van had been broken into and robbed and smashed up. We sort of took the gloss off it a bit. But unfortunately, that's the side of Liverpool that people don't talk about.
Well, from what I read, you know, your van got broken into quite a bit.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. But then I suppose, you know, it was a big white thing with a bus site written on the side. So... we did kind of advertise it. And luckily they didn't get too much stuff anytime they ripped us, so it wasn't so bad.
You know, I was thinking about, and I don't remember, I think it might have been your first trip to the United States where, I guess like most bands in the UK, you thought you were coming here to get rich and famous. But one of the things that really stuck out to me, and I don't remember what year it was, but I'm assuming it was after 9/11, we have one of your first impressions of coming to the United States was, you said, "I've never seen a more paranoid country in my life." What did it feel like to you?
It was strange. We came in March 2002, so literally, you know, just after 9/11, and it was extraordinary. There was just me and two guys. We went, just the three of us, to play for 2 weeks, and every single one of us was all three of us were taken off and searched and taken to separate rooms and quizzed, and it was like, I'd never experienced anything like it. You know, we were just sort of three lads from a small island that were just going to go and play some shows. And, they ended up dragging all our equipment out and testing it for explosives and all this stuff. It was, you know, I was just there with my mouth open, you know. But the problem was, I'm not very good at flying. In fact, I don't like it, so... I'd had a few beers to sort of take the edge off the fact that I was flying, and so I probably wasn't in a great state to be questioned, really, which probably didn't help. But it was very strange, that kind of paranoia. We don't have it here in the UK at all. In fact, I've never experienced it anywhere in the world.
Well, didn't you have a touch of that? Because it seems you were you were pretty close to that those 7/7 bombings.
We were literally around the corner, and in fact, they thought there was some reason involved, because we were recording at the time in Hoxton Square, just around the corner from where the bus exploded, and we were parking in central London is, you know, even bother, it's an insane amount of money to do it. We couldn't afford it, so we would turn up, we'd go into the studio, and our roadie and our driver would drive out, you know, kind of into the sticks a bit and park on the residential street and then get a bus back into the centre. And when the bombings happened, then all of a sudden, a couple of days later, our roadie, Nigel, he got a phone call from his mother down in South Wales. And the house had been raided by the police looking for him because the bus was registered at his mum's address in Wales.
Right.
And obviously they asked her where he was, and she said, you know where he is. He's in London, which is how you're here, you know. And then, so he had to phone the police, and they surrounded the bus with, you know, armed, and it was terrifying. And sort of Nigel had to sit in the bus with his hands above his head while they sort of approached. I don't know, you know, what they thought was going to happen, but it was really frightening, I must admit, because it was probably about 2 or 3 days after the John Charles de Menezes had been shot. So we were thinking, oh, Jesus, they're going to kill our roadie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it was all explained, and it was fine, and they apologized, and that was that. But yeah, it was very strange that we all sort of thought we were involved in it, you know. There you go, apart from a rock band, I suppose.
All right. Gareth, we're going to go to a short break. When we get back, I'd like to get back to that story of when you first came into New York, not New York, but when you first came to the United States outside Chicago, because I think that's hilarious. So stay with us. Gareth and I will be right back. Hi, it's Maria. I've got a question. How much more crap are we going to take? We're running out of time, folks, to wake up anyone with ears to hear. Government corruption, government lies, cover-ups, false flags, genetically modified organisms in our food, the HAARP program, chemtrails over our heads, pharmaceuticals in our water, poisons in our food supply, corrupted elections, being ruled by the elite 1% of 1%. When will it end? It'll end when everyone learns the information that's here on site, in my archives, and the new shows that I tirelessly put out 4 days a week. Available for pennies a day. Get over to maria.net, M-E-R-I-A.net. Pick a subscription of your choice. Get educated and then share that education. I've always believed if everyone in this world knew the information that I present on this show, now since 2000, we would change this world on a dime. So ask yourself while you're sitting back there if you've never supported my work, but still listen. How much more crap are you going to take? Get in there and get a subscription today. You'll be so happy you did, and you'll become one of the smartest people on the planet, able to decipher the fake news they give us every day. In instance, just like my listeners always manage to do. So for now, let's get back to this show. Okay, we're back. I'm speaking with Gareth Icke. We're talking about his hilarious book, How Not to Be a Rock Star. It might be a book you might want to buy your kids if they're thinking of starting up a garage band anytime soon. Just let them get a reality check, although I don't know that everything would be as bizarre as what happened to you and your group, Gareth.
Probably not.
while I was reading your book, I was sharing some of your stories in the book with some of my friends who found them very entertaining. And especially since we all, of course, have grown up in the United States. And your story about landing in outside of Chicago for the very first time and comparing it to the Bronx in New York. Now, you know, when I was a young girl many moons ago, we were forbidden to even drive through Bronx, okay? And it wasn't until I was, you know, maybe 18, 19, I couldn't understand, you know, why they thought the Bronx was such a dangerous place to drive through until I drove through it. And I remember saying, please God, don't let my car break down here. And that was, you know, we're talking late 60s. All right. So when you compare this place that you end up finding, I guess you must have booked your room online and didn't know where the hell you were going. I just found it hilarious because I don't know that I would have had the courage to stay in the motel that you guys ended up in.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, we grew up, I mean, I live in mainland England now, but before we grew up on the Isle of Wight, which is a tiny little island, sort of 13 miles by 26 miles. So it's quite sheltered, you know, so we'd never, when we arrived in Chicago, we'd never seen anything like that before. We'd never experienced anything like that. So the bass player, Steve, had booked the hotel online. And obviously, as you know, when you book something online, the pictures look great on the website, but it's very rarely like that in reality. And so we got in a cab outside the airport. We said to the guy, oh, this is the address. And he turned around and was like, are you sure?
Right.
Like, yeah, that's the address up there. The address on a bit of paper, and he kind of looked frightened for us. So as we were driving, we were going through quite nice areas, and I was thinking, oh, this is nice, you know, I don't mind staying around. Oh, no, we're not staying here, okay, keep going. And then the areas were getting slightly worse and slightly worse. But it was, okay, well, that's all right, I can stay here. And then we ended up in an area, I forget the name of it now, but oh my goodness, I was terrified. And we literally got to the motel, checked in, stuck all our stuff in the room, and then we didn't leave. We didn't leave the room for about 3 days, apart from in the daytime, to run across the road, get like a pack of beer and some food, and then run back to the hotel room.
Well, your own self-description of four skinny white guys with English accents landing in a neighborhood like that. I was laughing hysterically. I'm sure it wasn't funny to you at the time, but it sure was funny to me reading it.
Yeah, well, I can laugh now, but I can only laugh now because I'm still alive. You know, it was quite strange. But the thing, after the third day, I got the ump, really. I was annoyed because, you know, we'd gone all the way to America and it was, you know, we should be experiencing it sort of thing. And so after 3 days, I said, you know what, guys, you know, we're all skinny, but we're quite tall. And it was March, so it was quite cold. So I was like, look, we've got big sort of Parker thick sort of coats on, make us look bigger than we are. I thought, they don't know we are around here. You know, we could just walk around like we own the place. Which we did, which was quite funny. We walked into a bar, and it was almost like the swinging doors of the OK Corral, you know, when you walk in and the whole the jukebox stops, and everyone looks at you, and we were like, oh, no, we made a mistake here, you know. We should go back to the motel. And then the guy, he says, oh, you're British, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And then he ran out the back and came back with a television, put it on the bar to play football or soccer, as obviously you guys call it, and gave us some free whiskey. it worked to be walking around like you own the place.
Well, that kind of makes me happy, because the truth of the matter is the average American really likes foreigners, you know. We like everything about you, you know, your accents, you know, the different words you use. There were a couple of words in your book I really didn't understand the meaning of, but I said, okay, because we don't, I'm sure you know, we don't speak the King's English in this country. But you were staying in a place called Berwyn, but somewhere between, you know, drinking yourselves to death and traveling around looking for your gigs, you came across a big protest in the streets.
Yeah, it was the anti-war protest. We played probably about 25 miles outside Chicago, so we got a train out. Obviously, we had to get a train into the center when we got home, and then to get the L, I think it's called the L, to get the subway back to Berwyn. And, you know, we arrived, and it was the city center was quite tidy and calm when we left.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got back a few hours later, and it was, you know, there's police everywhere, and it was, oh my goodness, what's going on? So we started talking to some guys, and they were saying there was like, 50,000 actually, 50,000 people in an anti-war protest in the streets of Chicago. And I was thinking, you know, that's great, that's amazing that people are finally sort of coming out and protesting against this sort of stuff.
Right.
And then, you know, there's TV cameras everywhere and stuff. So, you know, we walked in front of the TV cameras a few times. So we were like, you know, let's get back to the hotel, you know, put CNN on, and we're bound to see ourselves, or, you know, see what really happened to the protest or whatever. And when we got back, it was all, I think they had a massive feature on three women in Alabama who were pro-war. And they didn't even mention, you know, 50,000 people in Chicago. I think it was 200,000 in New York. They didn't even mention it, but they had a big feature on three women in Alabama, which says it all, really, doesn't it?
Right. So, you know, there you are, a fairly young man. I mean, what are you, like 21 years old at the time? And you see this huge protest. You expect to see it on TV when you get back to your room, and it's not there. So what did that tell you about the media?
Well, that's it. I mean, I kind of, obviously, because I've grown up with it, with my dad, you know, I knew that anyway. I remember being on the Kill the Bill marches as a kid, the criminal justice bill marches in London. And they penned us all in. I mean, I was only a child, but they penned us all in Trafalgar Square. And then you saw, as you know, the armed police sort of, they opened up and let a load of people in, and they started kicking off and causing trouble. And then the police came in and arrested people, and they opened up and let the same people out again. And it was obviously totally orchestrated. And so even as, I mean, I'd have been, I don't know, been about 12 or 13. So even at that age then, I was stood there looking at that and,
right,
you know, realizing just how nonsense it all is, you know.
Right. So let me ask you this, as a musician and a songwriter, knowing where, you know, the space you have to be in to create, and you want to create beauty, of course, through your words and your music. How hard is that, and how do you manage to do that, having grown up with your father and knowing everything that, and I'm sure he talked about it all the time at home. I mean, I do the same around my children. How do you find the balance to still create and not be affected by it?
To be honest, my dad always said to me, he's finding a balance between saving the world and finding out how the football results are.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it is quite difficult to do that, to switch off. I know, you know, my girlfriend probably wishes I would switch off a bit more sometimes. But I think with the music, it's a really good release for me, because a lot of the bands that are kind of singing about this sort of stuff, they tend to be so alternative in their sound.
Right.
That they're almost preaching to the converted, you know, because the only people that are listening to it are people that agree with them anyway. Whereas with my music, I've tried to maybe even be slightly more mainstream in the fact that the songs are catchy and that you can sing along and you can tap along, but there is a real message behind them. So it's trying to, I remember Kurt Cobain saying a line in one of his songs where he said that the kids will eat it up if you package it properly. It's the same that, you know, was it Mary Poppins with a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
Right.
I think I feel like that a little bit with my music. If, you know, if I stood there and preached at people, then, you know, it would bore them and they'd want to turn off. But if you can kind of, you know, like What's Love Without Meaning? I mean, the song's catchy and it's got all the little bits and bobs in it, but there is a real message behind the lyrics and stuff. So if I can keep doing that, then hopefully it's working, you know, touch wood.
But, right.
That's kind of how I do it, really, just try and combine the two.
Right. Well, because I know, you know, from time to time, I'll ask my own children, you know, did you listen to this show I did or that one? And they're like, we don't listen to your show because we hear you talk all the time, you know. So I would think that you might feel the same way as my kids, you know, who for them, yeah, it's normal. That's all they've ever heard. So they still manage to live their lives independent of the stuff I talk about. You know, like they take it, but they don't let it affect their life because we're still here to enjoy our lives too.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing, because I've grown up on it. You know, I mean, a friend of mine the other day just collared me talking about Boston and the bombings, and he was like, you know, that's nonsense, man. You know, their story is nonsense, and there's no way that's what really happened, and this and that. And, you know, because it's new to these people, it's like a big deal, you know, and I'm obviously like, well, duh, you know.
Right.
Of course it's nonsense.
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, I say stuff to my girlfriend and she'll be like, what? And then I almost seem a bit annoyed that she doesn't get it at first. And she does, you know, it's my fault. She'll say to me, look, you grew up on this. You know, this is all new to me, you know. And so it is quite hard to sometimes remember that not everyone, you know, this isn't normality to everyone. And to most people, actually, their government, you know, screwing them is a new thing they've realized. And, you know, they're not very happy about it.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I find that all the time. But, you know, for you, it's normal. You know, it reminds me of my granddaughter who, you know, I'm a Reiki master, and she's been a Reiki master since she's a little girl. And she called me the other day, and she's only 18. And she says, you know, Grandma, I was talking to a group of my friends about Reiki, and none of them knew what I was talking about. She says, how is that even possible? So I said to her, but Jenna, you grew up with it. So for you, it's very common. But to your friends, it's, you might as well be talking about something from the moon. So I think sometimes we tend to forget that. And then, you know, it's a little difficult, I would think, you know, drawing a partner to yourself that can really get who you are, because you know so much more than most people do. So it gets a little more difficult to, you know, find people you relate to. Maybe they should have like some sort of dating site for the awakened, maybe just for the awakened.
Yeah.
Now you guys experience, besides your terrible drinking binges, and I'm certainly not judging it because I think you've judged it enough. You guys experienced all kinds of crazy things. I mean, everything from teenage pimps to somebody dropping dead right after one of your performances.
Yeah, and I it was me that made him dance as well. So.
You made him dance. You made him dance. It was your fault. But, you know, that's a very funny story. I mean, not funny for the guy that died, but just the way you wrote it. Do you want to tell that story? Because as far as I can recall, you were throwing, you know, a make-believe dance contest for one of your T-shirts because it was the only thing you had as a gift. And this guy who already had shown you earlier in the night was a little nuts, decided to be in the dance. Do you want to pick it up from there?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a little bit of background. Basically, we were playing this gig in South Wales, down in the valleys, where it's very local and everybody knows everyone sort of thing. We got halfway through a performance and, you know, we'd gone off, taken a 15-minute break, and I'd gone to the toilet. This guy had come up to me and asked if I would promote this charity when I went back on stage, which, you know, obviously no problem. He said they're trying to raise money for a kid that needs treatment in America, and they don't have the money. So if you can talk about it, you know, we'll go around with a bucket and collect some money. So obviously I was like, yeah, cool, you know, no problem, I'll do that. Anyway, he walked off, and another guy came up to me and said, oh, he's lying, he's talking rubbish, you know. So when I walked out, I went up to the guy, and I was like, you know, what's this this girl's name that needs the treatment? Because I don't want to get the name wrong. And he didn't have a clue what I was on about, and he just made up the story and then forgot he'd made it up. So I was a bit annoyed by that, obviously, because I thought, you know, you can't be making up stories about stuff like that. So we played the show, and then at the end, we were doing a dance competition, like I said, to win a T-shirt. So a few people were up and dancing, very drunk, because they like their beer in Wales. And so I spotted him, so I said, oh, you're getting up. I said, because, you know, I'm going to get him back. And he wouldn't get up, but the power of having a microphone over a room is incredible. So I basically just got everyone to shout at him until he got up. Which he did, and he won a bad donkey, to be fair to him, he was all right. And so at the end, we said, oh, you know, we'll give him the T-shirt then, because he was quite good, and and then he just dropped dead, better than them. And I shouldn't laugh, really, should I? And I turned to my guitarist, you know, the room was silent, and I turned to the guitarist and said, yeah, pack up the gear, we're going, and we packed up the gear and got out of there as quick as we could.
Right.
So,
But didn't after he won the T-shirt, didn't he just turn around and sell it to somebody else?
He did, yeah. We gave him the T-shirt, and he sold it to another guy that was dancing against him. He sold it to him for a fiver, which was, I think, probably more than we were charging for the T-shirt anyway. So he's made himself a little profit there.
Well,
not that he got to spend it.
Right. What about your second trip to the States when you went to New York City? What was that like for you?
That was incredible. It was still one of the best weeks of my life, actually, because we weren't gigging out there. It was our guitarist's 21st birthday, and we decided to all go to New York as a band. And that was what was so good about the band, to be honest, because even though we lived together in the bus for months on end, we were never sick of each other. You know, we just loved each other's company, and we got on. So we all went out to New York for a week. And, you know, we did the touristy stuff during the day, but at night just drank and ended up in gay bars every night, which is good fun because, you know, they know how to party.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had an absolutely great time.
Well, you had quite the interesting stories in New York, too. Didn't the four of you end up... I don't know. I guess you just turned into the wrong bar when you showed up at Rawhide, and it turned out to be a gay club.
Yeah, which is a great name for a great gay club, isn't it, Rawhide?
I think so.
we didn't have a clue. But what happened was there was a couple of guys dancing, sort of topless dancing. So we were like, hey, you know, let's have some fun. So I was putting sort of dollar bills in this guy's thong. We were posing for photos, as you do. And Turlo, who was the drummer, was so drunk he didn't know what day it was drunk.
Uh-huh.
And I was saying, Turlo, give him some money. So he's put his hand in his pocket and he's pulled out his money, but it's
change, you know, coins. And he's just thrown the coins. And obviously they've hit the dancer, and the dancer's gone mad. And so the next day, when Turlough woke up with a massive hangover, we made out that he'd been really homophobic, which he hadn't in any way, because he's
right.
not. But we'd made out to him, because he didn't remember the night. We'd said, you know, you threw money at the guy, you were calling him this, you were calling him that. You know, wow, this is really bad, so I didn't think you were like that. And obviously he couldn't remember anything that had happened. He was mortified. He was like, oh, no. So we basically decided that the only way he could prove that he wasn't homophobic was by kissing men.
Right.
Obviously, because, you know, it's only fair, isn't it? So the next night we went out and we made him get off with various middle-aged men. And we would take Polaroid photos of it because we thought it was funny. I mean, basically, it's bullying, isn't it, really?
Well, you were young. You were young kids just pulling pranks on each other.
But then when we got back to England, obviously, we had all the Polaroids, and we were looking through them in the pub when his girlfriend walked in and said, oh, can I have a look? And she found probably about 12, I think, photos of him kissing various men, which their relationship didn't last much longer.
Right, because there was a prank gone bad. Do you still see these guys? Do you still hang out? Are you still friends?
Yeah, we are. In fact, Tim, who was the guitarist, he played bass at Wembley with me. Turlough, who was the drummer, we're still really good friends. And he actually came up to, I live in Derby now, he came up here for a weekend a couple of weeks ago, and it was quite funny, actually, because we were the two probably biggest drinkers in the band. And so he came up for a weekend, and we were like, you know, let's push back the clock and be like we were in the old days. And so we tried to drink like we did then, and I think he was asleep by 8:30, and I think I got to about 9 p.m. Before I passed out.
Well,
we realized that we can't do what we used to.
No, you can't. No, you can't. And if you do, your body's going to make you pay for it for quite a few days.
Exactly.
So
at least
you had your good time while you were young. Not that you're old now, but it's all perspective, of course. Now, I understand you're performing in Manchester August 2nd.
Yeah. I signed to a Manchester label. It's a strange thing, actually, because when I recorded this album, A Brand New Battle, I recorded it myself, and I paid for it myself and stuff.
Right.
And I decided, for whatever reason, that it was going to be my last album. And I thought, you know what, I've been battling for years to try and do it, and there isn't the money in gigging, and so it's really hard to do. So I decided to go into personal training. So I was taking this personal training course, and I was going to record this album, and that was going to be that. And then I broke my leg broke it twice, tibia and fibula snapped clean in half. So my personal training went out the window. And then while I was in hospital after surgery, I got approached by a label in Manchester asking to sign myself and the album. So it was almost like, you know, someone was trying to tell me to not quit music. So I took that as a sign and thought, you know, so I signed with the label, and they're putting on this show in Manchester, which is sold out, actually. It's sold out in only about 2 or 3 hours, which is mad, you know. So,
that's great.
I know, I couldn't believe it, because promote it, and I said, yeah, so I tweeted it, and I went to put it on my site, and just as I was going to put it on my website, he phoned me and said it sold out. I was like, what?
Wow.
That's never happened to me before. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, so, the trick is to not quit when you're 3 feet from gold. And obviously you weren't supposed to give up your music, because I think your music has a great sound. You know, it's not only, you know, the sound, but the lyrics, all of it. And you have two albums out, right? Was your first one Remember Who You Are?
No, the first one was It Gets Worse at Night, and then my second album is A Brand New Battle.
Oh, okay.
Remember Who You Are was the first single off of this latest album.
Oh, interesting. Isn't that like the subtitle of one of your dad's books, or wasn't that the name of the Wembley event?
It was, yeah. He actually messaged me asking me to write these songs for Wembley, and I'd actually already written that song.
Huh.
Which is cheating, really. But I just added in the line, Remember Who You Are, which fitted with the song, and it was almost like, you know, it was meant to be, sort of thing. So
That's great.
That's up to like 160,000 hits on YouTube, which, you know, obviously to big bands is nothing, but to me it's like...
That's a whole lot of hits, especially on YouTube where there's a gazillion things people could be looking at. So your website is GarethIke.com, and people can get information there on you and your where you're going to be playing. And can they also order your music through your website?
Yeah, they can. So just go to GarethIke.com. It's all there. You can order the book. You can order CDs. And obviously there's live shows being announced at the moment. I'm touring a lot this year because of my leg, I haven't toured very much because I haven't been able to, but now it's a lot better and stuff. So I'm going to be in Australia this year and Germany and the Czech Republic and all these places. So dates are being announced kind of every week.
Well, that's fabulous.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, you have a little...
To just get back.
Right, I know you have a little sign up there for your newsletter, I guess, whatever bulletins you put out. I did put my name there so I could stay abreast of where you are and what you're doing.
Wicked. The best way to do it is if people are on Twitter at all, which I know is like a newfangled thing, but it's just twitter.com/GarethIke. And obviously anything on there I'll tweet. And I tend to kind of sort of talk a lot more about sort of what Dad talks about on there as well. So if I get kind of information from people, then I'll retweet some quite interesting bits and bobs. So if people are obviously, like a lot of your listeners are into my dad, then there's quite a few things on the Twitter that Dad will send me sort of privately. He'll email me saying, you know, check this out. And so I tweet them. So there's always new information on there.
Yeah, I'll look
into the music.
Absolutely. I'll look for you on Twitter. Are you also on Facebook? Because I know your father posts a lot of stuff there, too. All right, I'll be looking for you. Well, Gareth, I want to thank you for joining me today, for writing the book, because it gave me quite a few days of pleasure and a few good laughs.
Well, that's good. Hopefully, if it makes people laugh, puts a smile on their faces, then I'm happy.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much. And again, it's been a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you very much for having me, and hopefully I'll speak to you again.
Okay, you take care now.
Bye.
Gareth Ike, How Not to Be a Rock Star. That book cracked me up. And I'll tell you what, if it doesn't take you down memory lane to your own youth, then maybe you didn't have one. Anyway, tomorrow Ellen Brown's going to join me on the show on all her latest information. So stay with me. And again, thanks for supporting the show. See you
Thank
guys
you for
tomorrow.
Listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.